part 8 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Conclusion of the Final Chapter of Book 2.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, after a long hiatus occasioned by Christmas and Epiphany and various matters of that sort, we resume our studies of the Red Book of C.G. Jung, and in order to perhaps put some of this material in the proper sequence, I need to mention some circumstances that have to do with the writing and the compilation of the book that probably we mentioned in bare outline form, but that we may need to be reminded of, and that is this, that of course Jung did not write the Red Book immediately in the beautiful calligraphed and illustrated form that we see in the book, but that the text of the Red Book was first written by Jung into much smaller, much more unpretentious notebooks, which are covered in black, and characteristically they are called the Black Books. And you will see some of them exhibited at the Red Book exhibit that is coming to our great delight to Los Angeles, and that I've just been informed will start at the Armand Hammer Museum on the 11th of April. And will be there, I think, through the early part of June. I'm not quite sure how long. There are some of the black books exhibited there too. Then from the black books, there were yet other stages where the material there was copied, then was typed, then Jung looked it over, added to it, and then he transferred them, which often with some amendations, with his beautiful, unusual calligraphy, which he never used for any other purpose, into the Red Book. Now, I am not good at figures, by which I mean numbers, and so I will not go into which year which portion was written, but the Red Book as such, the calligraphed version of the Red Book as it stands, was written, as I recall, not much more than about a year's time. And then at World War I came, Jung entered the Swiss Army as a medical corps officer. I think he had the rank of either captain or major, and that took him to various places. He was guarding interred prisoners in and so forth. That sort of the whole matter was interrupted. And then he continued subsequently. And there is also a very large portion, which we will begin next time, which never came to be entered in calligraphed or other form into the Red Book, but which quite obviously belongs to it. It was in, again, in the black notebooks, and the dates, the first date of that particular portion, picks up right where the previous one ends. So it was obviously intended as a continuation, but that was included in the Red Book only now at its publication and was never transcribed in the calligraphy by Jung. And that is the portion, quite a large, something other taking place. It's very difficult to discern exactly what it is. So I think the danger of a kind of archetypal possession is probably the clue to this situation. Then he discourses with Salome and with Elijah again. And Salome says to him, "What a hard and incomprehensible man you are." And Elijah says, "You have changed since I last saw you. You speak another language, one that sounds foreign to me." And Jung says to him, "My dear old man, I'd like to believe that you find me changed, but you too seem to have changed. Where is your serpent?" Because they had a serpent with them too. And Elijah says sadly, "She has gone astray." I believe she was stolen. Since then, things have been somewhat gloomy with us. Therefore, I would have been happy if you had at least accepted my daughter. Well, it's a kind of a strange logic, but if you lost the serpent, then you might as well get rid of your daughter also. I can see something in that, you know. Mm-hmm. So Jung says to him, I know where your serpent is. I have her. We fetched her from the underworld. She gave me hardness, wisdom, and magical power. We need her in the upper world, since otherwise the underworld would have had the advantage to our detriment. This is rather transparent symbolism of bringing some power, some serpent power up from the underworld and have it available in consciousness, bringing the serpent as a particular power has been brought into consciousness by Jung and is no longer down in the underworld. Elijah doesn't like this, however. He says, away with you, accursed robber. May God punish you. And Jung says to him, your curse is powerless. Whoever possesses the serpent cannot be touched by curses. No, be sensible, old man. Whoever possesses wisdom is not greedy for power. Only the man who has power declines to use it. Do not cry, Salome. Fortune is only what you yourself create and not what comes to you. Be gone, my unhappy friends. The night grows late. Elijah, expunge the false gleam of power from your wisdom. And you, Salome, for the sake of our love, do not forget to dance. That's her job. Job is to dance. So the relationship to both has changed. Let's see. There is, I think, a little more dialogue going on with these folk. So the rejection of Salome and of her offered relationship is difficult to interpret. As we see it in context, the rejection does not appear to have been as final as it initially seemed, because Salome reappears again. As we see it in context, it doesn't seem to be quite as final. It seems that some further changes in Jung himself were required also before he could permit himself a closer relationship with Salome. One has to have a great deal of psychic strength when dealing with archetypes and when resisting, let's say, their tendency to obtain dominance over our consciousness. We need to interact with them. We need to get, you know, some of their wisdom, but we are not to be taken over by them. Now, Jung returns to the transformative mysteries which he experienced earlier in his process when he was crucified and returned the power of sight to Salome. He exclaims, mysteries, open your curtains again. I want to wage this battle to the end. Come here, serpent of the dark abyss. That's, of course, the serpent who is with him. The serpent appears again, and Jung complains to the serpent about the painful sacrifice he must undergo. He would like to get his mind off Salome, but the serpent reminds him that his sacrifice is necessary. Then he hears Salome crying, and he is greatly affected. He asks the serpent for advice, and they agree that such advice has to come from the beyond. So we have in this portion of the book the frequent reference to the beyond, and then the serpent becomes the messenger who goes to the beyond and brings back some directive, brings back some message. So the beyond is the deep unconscious to which in the ordinary course of affairs we have no access. So the serpent says He asked the serpent for advice, and they agreed that it has to come from the beyond. The serpent says that it is pulled upward. The serpent feels pulled upward, like he doesn't go down anymore as he did or she did before. She's always called she, and feels that she is pulled upward. And the serpent, behold, the serpent changes into a bird, which soars into the clouds and disappears. Jung then hears the voice of the bird saying that it has found a crown in the heavens. The bird describes the crown as follows: a golden royal crown with lettering inscribed within, saying, "Love never ends." Replying to Jung's questioning, the bird says that even though it may prolong the suspense, it is as it must be. So Jung is eventually, we see him, is actually once again suspended and crucified, and is undergoing another big sort of initiatory change. Now, a bit of tentative commentary of our own may be useful here. Once again, I would venture to suggest that Salome is Jung's anima. He has awakened her. He made her conscious at his initiations, that is, when she recovered her sight. Now the anima wants to be activated in various ways, either by taking him over or probably also by projection, where desire and love are mingled. And Jung rejects this at this point, but advised by the wise serpent, he realizes that the solution must come from a higher level. The serpent changing into a bird is the instrumentality of discovering this. The royal crown, declaring that love never ends, may help Jung to get off the cross upon which he is hanging, signifying indecision. In other words, he is in an undecided condition, and now help is coming him from a transcendental realm. The crown has the power to redeem Jung from his crucified state, but he does not understand this yet. Incidentally, the serpent that metamorphosed into the bird is Jung's soul in its dual earthly and heavenly aspect. As we will see later on when we come to the seven sermons to the dead, or if some of you who have read perhaps my translation and commentaries on the seven sermons to the dead in the Gnostic Jung, there a great role is played there by a serpent and a bird, the white bird. The white bird that comes from above and brings messages, and the serpent that goes on into the deep and brings wisdom from there. And so the implication here is that we, just like Jung, have, let's say, a duality of our soul, psyche. And these dual powers consist of one power that has the capacity to descend, let us say, into the realms that are deeply down below and that have to do with the earthly and the instinctual kind of wisdom of the cosmos. It may have occurred to many of you as to how much mention is made in various kind of New Age circles and so forth. You know, everything is cosmic, you know. I used to know a very dear old English lady who was, you know, she was sort of the hostess of the California occult in the 1950s and the 1960s, God rest her soul. And we always used to refer to her soirees as the cosmic tea parties, you know. I trust that she gives them now in another less material realm. In any event, you know, everything is cosmic, everything is cosmic. Well, this is, let's say, the realm of the serpent. We can derive wisdom from the deeper strata of the world. We can send the serpent into the dark caverns and passageways of the earth and have him bring back various items of wisdom from there. And they are useful to us.
But we cannot succeed in the spiritual process purely by way of that. So eventually the serpent changes into the bird. Now the other aspect appears. And this is the one that goes to a supernal, to a transcendental realm. And in so doing brings us the kind of wisdom that the serpent cannot supply. I just allude in archetypally and artistically to the motive of the serpent and the bird. There is a lot of interesting material on that. Have you ever looked at the national coat of arms of Mexico? It's the eagle carrying the snake. And of course the legend behind it is that when the Aztecs came to what is now Mexico City, which was a kind of a swamp, some people feel that it's still much of a swamp with all the crime and so forth going on there. But in any event, the first thing that they saw was an eagle who was fighting with a rattlesnake and who grabbed the rattlesnake and flew off with it. So, you know, this is a kind of natural and martial symbolism of the two, the power of the netherworld, the snake, and the power of the overworld, the bird. Now certainly the eagles always considered a very archetypal bird, the messenger of the gods of Jupiter particularly and so forth in the ancient world. That when the bird and the serpent appear together, then you have the energy from below and the energy from above that are conjoining. And only once in my life did I see it happen in this neck of the woods. We were driving out on the Malibu Canyon Road and looked up. There was a hawk carrying a snake. And the snake was still riding and moving. So this is the duality of the human psyche, the part of our psyche that is able to derive power and wisdom from the earth, and the power of the psyche that derives wisdom from the heavens. And these are the ones whom we see here. So Salome is here now discoursing with Jung again. See, she hasn't really gone away. So Salome tells Jung that he is to be crowned. But what this means, she won't tell him. Her words are, hang until you understand, because he's there hanging on a tree again, he's hanging on a cross. So it's interesting to note that it is right at this point where Jung is brought the golden crown, and he is still hanging on the cross, that the calligraphic entry into the red book ceases. That is where he did not enter anymore into the calligraphy, although he wrote in the black books. It's anybody's guess why, but I'm sure Jung would be the first one to agree that such synchronicities are not without a meaning of their own. So that is where the rest of book 2 and the entirety of the part called scrutinies were found in the black books and in transcriptions which were intended to be entered into the red book. Now, Jung's suspension between heaven and earth, a veritable crucifixion agony, continues. Various spectral creatures appear to him as he is hanging there. One, a raven, who argues with him, telling him that the meaning of love never ends, which is inscribed on the crown, as the bird read the inscription on the crown and told him, that this is up to Jung's notion of love. The next creature to talk to him is another serpent. I tell you, snakes abound here in great profusion, who appears to be related to his own serpentine soul. This serpent is willing to help him, but confesses that this is a situation that is beyond its power. And the serpent tells him, you can use me in life, but not in hanging. The magic of the serpent does not suffice here. Soon, with a scornful laugh, our old friend Satan himself appears. He no doubt warmed himself in his underground warm place, and now he is here again. He calls to Jung, see what comes from the reconciliation of the opposites. recant, and in a flash you will be down on the greening earth. He calls it here the greening earth. This, while we might call it stealing a little bit of a few words from Kazantzakis, The Last Temptation of Jung, this is rejected by Jung. No, I am not going to renounce my quest for the reconciliation of the opposites, no matter what you say, old hot smelly one, you know. So he says rejected by him because he has no intention of recanting. Jung calls to his white bird, which has not shown itself yet. It went up, hasn't come back. So just maybe a minute of commentary here. Let's say the temptation is always before us in so many ways to renounce the difficult quest. Find some kind of a short but false way of dealing with the situation. Not to endure the tension of the opposites. And that is what he is doing here. He hangs on that cross because he is the instrument there of the interaction of the opposites, and he's trying to find a way within himself to reconcile them. But it's a terribly painful and arduous and lengthy process, and so the temptation is always there. Come on, you know, give up on this quest. Just take some kind of a false solution for it, and then everything will be all right. And that is, of course, what the devil tells him. And such false solutions, of course, are innumerable. I mean, we could be here all night and all week until the rains come back and go again to look at the kind of false solutions that the mind offers up, but they are always there, depending on the psychological type, depending on the situation of the individual. But there is an anecdote about Jung and a patient of his, and the patient brought a dream to him that she was sinking into a dark mire, like a swamp, you know, she was sinking down. And she obviously was quite unhappy about that, and she tried to get out, but she couldn't. And then she dreamt that Jung came sort of like a little winged creature, came flying along and looked down at her from above as she was struggling there in the mess. And she, help me out, help me out. And she looked down at her and said, not out, but through. So this is the kind of thing, when you endure the process, even though it's painful, you endure the tension of the opposites, then you come out with something better. But when you choose some kind of a seemingly easy but yet not authentic way, then you are merely remaining in the condition in which you were, and no real, you know, no real transformation takes place. And so he is there hanging in, and he calls to the white bird. Salome appears, but she only says to Jung, ask yourself about the solution. You know? Then the bird arrives, and after a brief dialogue, he answers Jung's question, and Jung asks him, what should happen to Salome? But this is one of the great issues. He could not accept the anima, the way the anima was coming forth. But something needs to be done. She is still there, and he doesn't quite know how to deal with her. And the bird answered, you see, Salome is what you are. Fly, and she will grow wings. So the indication being that the anima and you are really one, and as your consciousness takes wings, she also will, and she will fly along with you. Quite a verification of the idea that she is his anima. Then a frightful vision afflicts Jung. He sees a misshapen and seemingly inimical being arise, whom he identifies as his son of a magical kind. Jung identifies this creature with very derogatory terms. He calls him a destroyer, This is a good one which I shall use on some people I know. A bug-eyed frog. A bug-eyed frog. Now, that's a nice thing to call somebody. A ridiculous and disgusting being. In his despairing wrath, Jung even blames Philemon for having magically afflicted him with this false son. Apparently his sense is that this was somehow the result of Philemon's magic, but it's a very ugly and very distasteful creature that appears before him here. Jung is extremely disturbed, and his serpent soul then comforts him with a long tale of a king who had no son and who went to a sorceress in order to magically create a child. The child is created and grows unnaturally fast, and having grown up strong and big, he roughly and impolitely and wildly demands that the royal father hand over the royal power to him. The king doesn't like that. He is taken aback and disappointed, and then he decides to have the son secretly killed, which comes to pass once again in a magical manner. But the king, this is the latter part of the story that the bird tells him. But the king was saddened, and when he could no longer master his melancholy, he returned yet again to the sorceress one night and asked for her advice. She spoke to him, "Dear king, you wanted a son, but the son wanted to be king himself, and also had the power and cleverness for it, and then you wanted your son no more. Because of this, you lost your son. Why are you complaining? You have everything, dear king, that you wanted, but the king said you are right. I wanted it so, but I did not want this melancholy. Do you have any remedies against remorse?" The sorceress spoke, "Dear king, go to your son's grave. Fill the pot again with otter's lard." Now that would be difficult to obtain. No doubt some old Swiss home remedy or something of that sort. "Fill the pot with otter's lard, and after 9 months see what you find in the pot." The king did this and as he had been commanded, and henceforth he became happy and did not know why. When the 9 months had passed, he dug out the pot again. The body had disappeared, but in the pot there lay a sleeping infant, and he realized that the infant was his dead son. He took the infant to himself, and henceforth he grew as much in a week as other infants grow in a year. And when 20 weeks had passed, the son came before the father again and claimed his realm. But the father had learned from experience and already knew for a long time how everything would turn out. After the son had voiced his demand, the old king got up from his throne and embraced his son with tears of joy and crowned him king. And so the son who had thus become king was grateful to his father and held him in high esteem as long as his father was granted life. Now Jung then asks the storytelling serpent to give him an interpretation of this story. He says, all right, what does this mean? As might be expected, the serpent's interpretation is enigmatic. You know, it's a way they have, snakes. But the meaning that emerges is fairly plain. In our own words, even as indicated earlier in the book, in the story of Izdubar that you may remember, so here also we are dealing with the bringing into manifestation of an other being who eventually reveals himself as the higher or divine self, known in the later formulation in Jungian psychology as the self with a capital S. The revelations given to Jung in the Red Book make it quite plain that recognizing this self and bringing it into conjunction with the human personality is really the great task of the human being. While the awakening of this self can be a glorious event, as described by the Red Book, as in the resurrection of Izdubar in the egg that some of you may recall, here Jung reminds us that at times the personality may resent the coming of the self and resist with great force and anger. The metaphor of the birth of a child is a common one. People, both women and men, have dreams of giving birth to a child. the serpent tells Jung that he must become both father and mother to the new child. There is also a role reversal when the personal ego must acknowledge that it is the child of the self. The serpent says, for the sake of your son, you must be a child and leave your son the crown. That is what the story was all about, to convince him of that. Jung says, the thought that I must remain a child is humiliating and shattering. The serpent says, a salutary antidote against power. You know, you're still too concerned with your power. He says, you have to remember the sun stands higher. You are smaller and weaker than the sun. This is the bitter truth, but it can't be avoided. So subject yourself to the sun. Jung then very correctly recognizes that the subjection of the father, the personality, the Jung as he knows himself, to the son is a confrontation with a supernal being. And he says, where am I going to take hold of the immeasurable? My knowledge and ability are poor. My power is not enough. The serpent replies, do not ask after the morrow. Sufficient unto you is the day. You need not worry about the means. Let everything grow, let everything sprout. The sun grows out of himself. So what we have here is a paradox, which you probably have confronted a number of times within yourselves. Namely, first of all, there are, and there are needed, and there come about magical, mystical processes and events, initiations and transformations, the guidance of Philemon, bring Jung to this point. Yet, while he is in the midst of this confrontation with the self, he is told in effect that it is a natural process of growth. Just let it happen. Or as Jung has said, and as I love to quote him whenever possible, I don't make myself, I happen to myself. So what does this mean? It means we have to accept the stimuli that come to us in various ways on the way of transformation, on the way of the birth of the self. But once we are there, then let the self be self. Let the self come and take over. Just be relaxed. Let it happen. Don't try to make it happen. Don't try to dress it up. Don't try to glamorize it. Don't surround it with all kinds of things that you make up in order to make it look better to yourself. Let it happen. And when you let it happen, it happens. It's that accepting and really relaxed attitude that is extremely important. And then Jung says the myth commences, the one that need only be lived, not sung, the one that sings itself. That's a wonderful expression, the one that sings itself. I subject myself to the sun, the one engendered by sorcery. Truly he is full of mysteries and superior in strength to all men. No man has produced him, and no woman has given birth to him. And so he is told that the serpent tells him, imagine that you are the old king and have a son. And then says, well, says, who is the son? Well, I thought that you had just spoken of a son who doesn't make you very happy. In any event, he is convinced of the need to give way to this new being. So essentially, Jung relinquishes power to the greater self, who is called his son in this instance. He realizes that his life is enriched by this. It is implicitly recognized that all his resistance, his wrathful imprecations, some who were even directed against Philemon, were mistaken and misplaced. The son has become a divine being to him, and he says, he speaks of the son, he broke me into two, he cut me up, but he yokes the separated. Without him, I would fall apart. But my life goes on with him. My love remained with me. Jung describes a scene how he is still nourishing some resentment at his spiritual son's newly won dominion. He repaired to his garden. Then from the water emerges his son, great and powerful, the crown in his hand. And these are the words that are in the book. With a swirling lion's mane, shimmering serpent skin covering his body. And this, of course, later on in the seven sermons, Jung calls a being like this Abraxas. And this was the figure, or is, I suppose it's still available, that Jung had carved into a stone and wore in his large ring that is usually called his Gnostic ring. It's a serpent with a lion's head and a lion's mane and a spiked halo surrounding his head. And that is the image that appears here as the image of his greater self, of this spiritual son. And this being now announces that he is about to depart. He says, I had become man and beast and now ascend again to my country. When asked, where is your country? He answers, in the light, in the egg, in the sun, in what is innermost and compressed, in the eternal longing embers. So rises the sun in your heart and streams out into the cold world. And then the God is giving him a sort of a farewell speech. And here it is. He speaks to Jung. Jung says to him, you utter great riddles. And the God says to him, such is my language, and to you I leave the understanding. No one besides you has your own God. He is always with you, yet you see him in others, and thus he is never with you. You strive to draw to yourself those who seem to possess your God. You will come to see that they do not possess him, and that you alone have him. Thus you are alone among men, in the crowd, and yet alone. Solitude in multitude, ponder this. And he says, Jung says, I suppose I ought to remain silent after what you have said, but I cannot. My heart bleeds when I see you go from me. And he says, let me go. I shall return to you in renewed form. Do you see the sun, how it sinks red into the mountains? This day's work is accomplished, and now the sun returns. Why are you mourning the sun of today? And Jung says, must night fall? And he says, is it not mother of the day, the night as mother of the day? And Jung says, because of this night, I want to despair. And he says, why lament? It is fate. Let me go. My wings grow and the longing toward eternal light swells up powerfully in me. This is again one of these beautiful poetic passages. You can no longer stop me. Stop your tears and let me ascend with cries of joy. You are a man of the fields. Think of your crops. I become light, like the bird that rises up into the skies of morning. Do not stop me, do not complain, already I hover, the cry of life escapes from me, I can no longer hold back my supreme pleasure, I must go up, it has happened, the last cord tears away, my wings bear me up, I dive up into the sea of light, you who are down here, you distant twilight being, you fade from me. And he says, where have you gone? Something has happened, I am lamed. You know, has the God left him? And I believe and accept that the God is something different from me. He swung high and jubilant, with jubilant joy, I remain in the night of pain, no longer with the God, but alone with myself. So the important statement here is, I believe and accept that God is something different from me. So the self, the indwelling God, is in us, and yet it is different from us, in the sense that it is utterly different from the human ego or personality. It is the human soul as against the divine soul. The self manifests and then returns to its own place. This is the way it always happens. If anybody tells you that the self, the indwelling God, has come and is always there, unchanged or undiminished, they are making it up. That's not the way it works in a human being. Comes, and he goes back to his own place. But you know it's there, and you know it's going to come again. And as you say, he's going to come in a different form. Yet the God tells Jung, I shall return to you in renewed form. And he likens himself to the sun that sets in the evening and returns in the morning. The such then is Jung's extremely dramatic confrontation with the inner God. At first he is horrified by its lowly form. Then, instructed by the serpent, he begins to see that he must relinquish his royal crown, which I would interpret as the power of his ego, to this being, who metaphorically appears as his son. Having done so, the God ascends to his own place, promising to return in renewed form. In the draft writing, not transcribed into the calligraphy, a curious paragraph appears, which is reproduced here, which possibly may point to future developments. That's at the very end of book two. It begins with the words, an opus is needed that one can squander decades on and do it out of necessity. He then indicates that he must, as he puts it, and these are his words again, catch up with a piece of the Middle Ages within himself. I would say that this is in all likelihood a prefiguration or an affirmation of Jung's channeling of the inspiration of the Red Book into alchemy, which occurred a good deal later. And underneath this paragraph, which is completely unrelated to the rest of the text, he wrote, finish. But of course it wasn't really finished, because the wealth of the material called scrutinies came thereafter, and it is to those that we will devote ourselves in the ensuing discussions. But I think we should leave with the very, very important and powerful thought and insight that the coming, the birth, the difficult and harrowing, initially resented birth of the greater self occurs within the individual. He recognizes him as such, and then the greater self goes back to its own place in order to come back to him again. And this, of course, is one of the two central points of the entire Red Book, that within us, potentially, there is a God. And this God must come forth. We must give birth to it, like a woman gives birth to a child. And when it has thus come forth, then he will be there and will be available and will continue to bless and guide us. And the indwelling power, of which we had just small intimations before, now will be there effectively, will irradiate, enlighten our lives and lead us onward. And with that, the book two and the calligraph part actually has ended before, comes to an end, and that great explanatory and mysterious further revelation in scrutinies, as they are called, are to follow, to which we shall devote ourselves on the next number of evenings. So I hope that this has been of interest to you, and I thank you very much.
Copyright Union by YouTube Program. Catalog number 200508.
I might also append, not for the record, that this was, to me at least, one of the most difficult passages to work through and to try to interpret of everything that we have done so far. But I am sure it's not. I am sure it's me. You see, I am sure it's me. So, anyway, there we are.
For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit Gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.